Spring, is that you? Warmer temps mean new Allbirds styles. Meet the new Superlight Collection, the lightest ever shoes from Allbirds, now in fresh colors. These must-have travel shoes have a lighter-than-air feel and barely-there fit that made them the most packable shoes ever. Plus, they're comfy right out of the box. That means more comfort and less baggage. Experience how Allbirds is redefining comfort. Visit Allbirds.com and use code SUPER24 for a free pair of socks with a purchase of $48 or more. That's ALLBIRDS.com, code SUPER24.
This is Oklahoma Perspective. Everybody gets them, but nobody likes them. They're robocalls. And recently, KRMG's Russell Mills talked to Jonathan Spalter with U.S. Telecom about what's being done to stop them.
This is a topic that is near and dear to my heart because literally here in the newsroom, I will get 5 to 6 robocalls per day. And then I'll take another 2 or 3 on my cell phone. It is a massive disruption in my life. So let's start by telling folks who you are and why we're talking with you. Jonathan Spalter is president and CEO of U.S. Telecom. That is not a telephone company. Can you kind of explain what U.S. Telecom is?
Sure. In fact, we are a trade association that works with broadband innovators, telephone companies. Many of them are actually in Tulsa and in Oklahoma, like Pottawatomie and Chickasaw and Pioneer and Epic Touch and the great folks that work there. But we're also representing all of the major broadband providers, telephone companies around the country. And what we do is we work with all of them to make sure that the policies in Washington and all of the states are actually going to allow us to get more and better broadband and more better telephone service, including telephone service on our mobile phones and our landlines, without this awful problem of robocalls.
So what are the phone companies doing? Because I hear a lot of people saying, well, the phone companies could stop this if they wanted to, but I'm not sure that they would agree. But what are they saying, or what is the feeling about this problem among the folks who actually run these businesses?
Sure. Well, you know, phone companies that are local, like Pottawatomie, all the way up to the big national providers like AT&T and Verizon and CenturyLink, they are loaded for bear. They're going to work spending literally hundreds of millions of dollars in technology and operations, making sure that we can provide consumers with services that, like AT&T's Call Protect or Verizon's Spam Alert, that blocks suspected fraudulent calls. Our telephone companies, carriers, are implementing on a voluntary basis really sophisticated call authentication and verification technologies. Not to geek out on you, it's called Shaken and Stir, kind of out of James Bond. But we're deploying this nationally to allow better ways of stomping out illegal and unwanted calls. The other thing we're doing is we're working hand in glove with law enforcement and government to make sure that we can actually get tough and have a real straight spine in dealing with these illegal actors. You know, just in March, there were close to 2.5 billion, with a B, illegal robocalls in the United States. Numbers getting worse. You know, the most vulnerable of our citizens are being actually targeted by these illegal actors to the tune of about $3 billion a year in scams. The good news is that we in industry are stepping up. And the last thing we're doing, and this is really important, is we're working together, even though we're competitive with each other. Under U.S. Telecom, we've stood up something called the Industry Traceback Group. So our engineers and executives can work to actually trace back where these illegal calls are happening from, and then hand over that information to law enforcement authorities so that these bad actors can go to jail. We want to see more of these people in perp walks heading to jail, and that's our aim.
Yeah, I got to tell you, I have this dream of, you know, jackbooted SWAT teams kicking down the doors of one of these places and just rounding everybody up and taking them in. And really, the thing is that these operations don't have to be large in order to make hundreds, even thousands of calls an hour because of the technology. And that's been part of the problem, right? The technology has outstripped the law.
It's very sophisticated. And it's not just thousands of calls an hour. We're talking about tens of millions of calls in a day. this is what they're capable of doing. A lot of them are here in the United States, but many of them are overseas. And that's why it's a great thing that Congress is getting going on passing legislation. Real tip of the hat to Senator Inhofe and Senator Lankford from Oklahoma for joining an almost completely bipartisan approach to begin to pass legislation to stomp out these illegal actors.
So my understanding is there are, to no one's shock or surprise, competing bills, one in the House and one in the Senate. How different are they, and how confident are you that a conference committee is going to be able to hammer something out that everybody can live with?
I am 100% confident that this issue, it's not a red or a blue issue, it's an American issue. We all are sick and tired of these calls. Our senators and congressmen all get them. They're going to sit down, work out a bill. It's going to be on the president's desk and signed, we hope, by the fall. More fines, more blocking technology, more coordination and criminalization of penalties with the Justice Department, the FCC, the FTC, the Department of Homeland Security, all involved. Easier ability to prosecute people, and ultimately putting more people in jail. This is what the legislation is going to do. It's going to encourage more carriers to actually work with U.S. Telecom in our industry traceback group. So it's going to be an all-hands-on-deck, bipartisan, national bill. And we're sure it's going to get done.
All right. So basically, there's attacks on several fronts on this problem. Let's talk a little bit more about that industry traceback bill. It sounds like just, and obviously I'm a complete neophyte when it comes to this technology. I know very little about it except whether my phone works or not. But basically the idea here is to literally be able to follow all these millions of calls that are coming from one of these, you know, robocall centers and trace them back to the physical location from which they are coming. Is that correct?
You bet. Think of the U.S. telecom industry traceback group as a SWAT team of technology and telephone providers who trace right back to the source of illegal robocalls, be they here in the United States or overseas, working with about almost 30 of our largest national carriers around the table to do this work. And then once we actually can technologically trace back where these calls are coming from, we can vector in very, very specifically, we're handing over that information to federal and state law enforcement agencies to bring these perps to justice. And Congress is actually encouraging participation in our traceback work. We also have teamed up with a bunch of really innovative call blocking companies that have started, like Umail and NomoRobo, on this work. And the bottom line is, you know, just this last month, we've done 150 of these tracebacks. We've contracted the amount of time it takes to do a traceback from what used to be days to sometimes now and even just hours. We're going to be pushing this forward to even greater technological progress so that we can have more scale. And this is just part of a broader mosaic of initiatives that needs to be brought to this problem. But I can assure you that your telephone companies, U.S. telecom members, are loaded for bear. We're ready for the fight. We're on the barricades, and we're taking this dead seriously.
So the other part of this equation, and you guys sent me a really nice, informative sort of one sheet about some of these efforts. But one thing I don't see here is the reason that this exists is because it pays. People are falling for these scams. How do we better educate people on, you know, you don't have unpaid, I don't know, student loan debt or whatever the topic of the call is. It just seems to me like it would be so patently obvious that you should just not even take that call. But for whatever reason, you said $3 billion people have lost to these scammers?
Yep.
In the course of how long?
Again, these are often our most vulnerable citizens. These are our senior citizens. And we have to be very, very careful. We have to do a lot of education. Go to ustelecom.org/robocalls. We've got a lot of resources for consumers that are available. The FCC.gov, FTC.gov sites are, you know, great resources. But the bottom line is don't pick up the phone if you don't know exactly who's calling you. A lot of spoofers now have technology that makes it seem like they're a neighbor or a number that you know. But if you're not dead certain about who is calling you, just don't pick it up. Let it go to voicemail.
Jonathan Spalter with U.S. Telecom. Oklahoma has drafted another cannabis law called the Unity Bill. Recently, KRMG's Russell Mills talked to Tulsa lawyer Ron Durbin about the new bill and about how difficult it's been for Oklahoma to draft sensible new marijuana laws.
I called to talk to you about the Unity Bill, as it's been dubbed. The Disunity Bill, as others have tagged it, not surprisingly. But there are a lot of other bills and laws and Senate resolutions and this and that that are all going into effect kind of simultaneously or concurrently, at least. And sometimes they work at cross purposes.
Yeah, so, I mean, we've got a lot of different bills that we're dealing with. We've got House Bill 2612, House Bill 2613, Senate Bill 882, Senate Bill 1030. We've got the OMMA's permanent rules that have come into effect. We've got, well, they come into effect on, I think, the 13th. We've got the emergency rules that Sid just signed that go into effect on the 14th. So we've got all these different bills that, you know, I don't know if there was some disunity in the legislature and the drafting of these things, but they didn't seem to be working together to kind of come up with one cohesive set of framework. And it's created a bunch of problems in the way that this program's being, these programs are being implemented in the state.
So let's talk about some of those problems. What are you seeing? What are your primary concerns?
Well, I mean, the first one is in Senate Bill 1030, they required a new certificate of compliance that all medical marijuana businesses have to get signed by their essentially their governing entity, whether it be a municipality or it be a county. And the OMMA, the Oklahoma Medical Marijuana Authority, and the Department of Health didn't do anything to prepare counties and cities for what they're going to be requiring them to sign off on. So we've got a huge problem with just complete uncertainty across the state of Oklahoma on who executes these certificates of compliance, who's paying for the work to be done to check and make sure these dispensaries and processors and growers are in compliance. And what we have is we have sort of a twofold problem. We've got all of these businesses that have licenses up for renewal, and they've got to have the certificate of compliance. And we've got counties and cities that don't know what they're supposed to be doing. And counties have gotten together at one of their last county meeting where a bunch of counties come together, and they've determined that Senate Bill 1030 is an unfunded mandate. And a lot of them are refusing to execute these certificates of compliance required for these businesses to renew their licenses.
Which leaves the businesses, what, in limbo? Or they either operate illegally or shut down? What do they do?
Well, I mean, that's the problem, is that there's no clear guidance or solution. And, you know, one of the things is, as a regulatory agency, we would think that the Oklahoma Medical Marijuana Authority would have, you know, realized that, hey, we're proposing these regulations on, let's say it was August 27th. We're going to make them effective on September 14th. We've got all these businesses that are up for renewal because they got their licenses when they first became available last year. We built in some kind of grace period to allow for cities and counties to come online. We would think that would have been something that they would have thought about, but it's not something that they thought about, or they didn't care enough to put it in their regulations.
All right. There's been a lot of talk about what this new law means for employees and employers, and, you know, who can or cannot use medical marijuana, or how they can or cannot use it on the job, or who can be terminated or not hired because of use of medical cannabis. Generally speaking, do you think the law comes down on the side of the patients or of the businesses, or is it somewhere in the middle, or is it, again, just confusing?
Well, I mean, the problem is, and I hate to use this analogy, but I will, I think that the people who are writing the safety-sensitive job portion of 2612, or at least editing it, were doing so with construction paper and crayons. They have made a law that is as confusing as it could possibly be on something that should be relatively simple. You know, if we'd applied the same standards that we apply to any employee that's utilizing any kind of prescription medication, and if that impacts their ability to perform their job, being able to take some kind of action, that would have made sense here. But that's not what they did. They created these safety-sensitive positions. They left it very open as to what is defined as a safety-sensitive position, and what the patient has to disclose, when we don't normally require people to disclose their medical conditions to employers unless it's an ADA-type situation. And so we're left in this quagmire of, you know, what are employers going to do with this? What kind of policies are they going to institute? And what kind of protections do patients have that are able to perform their job functions perfectly fine? They just won't be able to pass a test for THC in their system, because that stuff stays with them for long periods of time and doesn't show a level of intoxication.
Long after the intoxicating effects are gone.
Absolutely, because we test for, those tests test for what's called a metabolite, which is the breaking down of the substance. And that metabolite, those metabolites can be stored in fat, so it can be broken down over months and months at a time. So somebody who didn't even utilize THC for 2 months could still test positive for metabolites, depending on what their consumption level was a couple of months ago. So there's no clarity with regards to these issues and how an employer could deal with it, when it could have been simply as simple as you can't show signs of visible intoxication while performing your job duties. That is something that's quantifiable, that's noticeable, and that you can document. But they didn't do that. That's not how they defined these things in the law.
There's also been some concern over this information, medical information, HIPAA-protected information being shared with law enforcement.
Yeah, so there was a provision in Senate Bill 1030 that was, again, a very poorly drafted bill. I think it was Paxton that drafted that portion. And what it does is it provides for HIPAA-type protection for patient information. But then there's a provision that talks about releasing and sharing license information to the Department of Public Safety and the system that the police departments utilize. And the way, if you read the bill, the way it appears to me what they were intending was to release business information, not patient information. But that's not how it was being interpreted. Fortunately, the state of Oklahoma, we filed a lawsuit on that a couple of weeks ago. Fortunately, the Oklahoma Medical Marijuana Authority, through the Attorney General's office, has come in and agreed to a stipulation that they will not release that information while our court case is pending. And I have assurances from Representative Fettgetter and Representative John Eccles that the Oklahoma legislature will fix that oversight upon the next legislative session.
So something that they're aware that maybe they didn't tighten up the language the way they should have. Basically.
Yeah, exactly. And I think they're starting to become aware that this is an ongoing problem of, whoever's drafting this legislation is not looking at it for all the potential pitfalls and problems. I don't know where they're having this this breakdown in the basic understanding of how you interpret and enforce a law and how you need to look at the implications of the language that you're utilizing. But it's an ongoing problem. We have that problem with Senate Bill 882. They removed the word wastewater. Because they didn't want water to be part of the waste management program, but they left the word of anything containing debris, and wastewater inevitably will contain debris, because debris being the smallest part of something that's no longer distinguishable from the whole. So you remove a word because you're trying to fix and take out wastewater, but you leave this word debris, which is a broader term than what you had in there. So it's the same problem across the board always with these bills.
Well, and just looking over the bill, a couple things struck me. The title of the bill is, and I'm talking specifically about House Bill 2612, the title is 4 pages long.
Right.
Then you get into the definitions, and the definitions go and go and go and go. Let's see, before I actually get to the first part of the law, I think I'm on page 14.
That sounds about right. And 50-something pages, if memory serves.
Yeah, it's more than 50 pages of stuff, and it goes into excruciating detail on a lot of things, and yet somehow remains vague. You're right, I'm a little confused about all that.
Well, an example of that is where they're talking about they want outermost packaging to be opaque, and they don't bother to define what outermost packaging means, and so people are trying to say, well, is that the exit bag from when you leave the dispensary, or is it the actual package that the product's contained in? And then you've got the Oklahoma Medical Marijuana Authority that came out with some regulations that define packaging as not being an exit bag, and then their people are sending emails to confused processors that are trying to package their goods, and they're saying, no, we're only talking about the bags in which you exit, even though that's specifically excluded from the definition that they have in their regulations. So we've had just an utter and complete lack of accountability in these agencies to get these things right and provide rules and regulations that, somebody can comprehend. And I'm fairly well versed in the laws related to this issue in the state of Oklahoma. And there's oftentimes where I'm scratching my head trying to figure out what in the world they meant.
Tulsa Attorney Ron Durbin. Special thanks to KRMG's Russell Mills for the interviews. This is Oklahoma Perspective. For Cox Media Group, I'm Bert Williams.